Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 79. My name is Karen. Your name is...
Kristen.
That is correct. You are correct. That is your name.
I'm glad. There's not a lot of questions I can get right at this time in the morning. It's not that early.
It's 11 a.m.
I'm just not a morning person, so it takes me a minute.
But the sun is shining.
It is.
It is beautiful. It's going to be like 80 today.
It's my favorite time of year.
Yeah.
It's not 95 and 100 degrees. It's not 40. It's 80. 80 degrees
although,
is my happy place.
This year, I don't care, because we have central air.
Same here. In the past, we have not.
Yes, and it was very, very difficult
and
to
every
live.
Time we tried to record in a closed-door room, we would sweat to death by the time we were done. Yeah. It was like, open the door. Like, oh my God. So we don't have to worry about that anymore.
No, it's great.
So cool.
By the way, this is a complete segue to... this conversation, but I keep forgetting to bring up the fact that I've been playing Immortals Phoenix Rising. Have you heard of this video game?
Vaguely. Okay. I know I've heard of it.
If you guys haven't heard of this, and you love Greek mythology, which I assume you do if you're listening to this podcast, please go download this game. It feels very much like Zelda Breath of the Wild. There's basically a big open world. You can climb things, fight things. You can tame wild animals to ride them around. And it's all set in this big island where the Typhon has kind of defeated all of the Greek gods and turned everybody else to stone except for you. And so you have to go around saving the Greek gods and bring them back to life. And there are so many quests and so many items, and you can make potions and get stronger and increase your health stacks. And like, it's just a really cool game. There's a little bit of a learning curve. I'm still trying to figure out like all the godly powers and how to get them all. But it's a pretty, and you get to fight like minotaurs and wild boars.
Nice.
And
now, which
Cyclops.
System?
I have it on Xbox.
Okay.
You can play it on PC, although I noticed I started playing it on my computer, but then I wasn't getting Xbox achievements, which is like...
Karen's will to live.
A no-go for me.
It's in there.
I need to be rewarded for all of my actions. So I actually stopped playing it on the computer and started playing it on the Xbox so that I could... You can play it on PS5, too, because I was... looking at, there's a lot of puzzles in the game too, and I have learned something about myself recently, which is that I am impatient. And so when I can't solve something right away, I go to a walkthrough. Because if it's no longer fun trying to solve it, what's the point?
Right.
So the walkthrough that I was watching, the guy was definitely on PS5. So.
Gotcha.
There's that.
Is this on, by any chance, on Game Pass?
Yes, I believe that's where I have it. Because I usually don't pay for video games.
Because I, as much as I love Disney Dreamlight Valley, I am already completed the Star Path.
Oh, okay.
So I just have the five, I think it's five more things to do on the Star Path, but I've got everything from the Star Path.
Okay.
So now I just have like five little things to do and get the bonus moonstones. And once I have those, like... I'm basically done with this update.
Oh,
like,
okay.
I think I have a couple of quests with Simba and Nala left.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'm basically
I'm
done.
Trying to take it slow.
I know. I try and I fail all the time.
I think you would really like this game, though.
Yeah.
It's really
like,
cool.
Yeah, I downloaded, because I think Stardew Valley popped up on Game Pass, and I was like, I'll download it, I'll see, but I don't know. I'm so used to the new, like, 3D graphic environment.
Pixel, I like Stardew Valley a lot, but pixel art games are not usually my jam.
Yeah.
And Immortals Phoenix Rising is the kind of game that I love, where it's, like, open world, and you can just... it's really pretty,
and I started Breath of the Wild.
It's hilarious,
by the way. I was gonna say, I started Breath of the Wild on Switch, and I did enjoy it. I haven't been back to it, just because I've had a million things going on, but I really did like it. So, like, if it has that kind of, you know, open world feel thing, then I think I will end up Yeah, I'll try it out.
It's really funny because it's narrated by Zeus and Prometheus having this conversation. Because, like, the whole premise is Zeus goes to Prometheus to get him to help him stop Typhon. And they have to tell this story of Phoenix, the hero. And you can customize your character. Mine has purple hair. And they're, like, bickering back and forth the entire time. It's really funny. And it's, like, so... You could tell that whoever made this game, like, really knows Greek mythology. Okay. So I love it. So that is your recommendation for this week.
Nice.
If you guys have played it or start to play it, please let me know because I really like it and I would like to talk to people about it. You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. Before we get into our episode about Egyptian mythology and pop culture, we're going to jump into news and updates. We had two articles from Reed Riordan this week. The first one is like kind of a basic one. It's just minor Greek gods and goddesses you forgot existed. And, you know, some of them are ones that I recognize. Other ones weren't as much that I remember. So I guess it's a good thing that, you know, they did this article on it. I skimmed through it. Didn't really see anything that super popped out at me. But the other Reed Riordan article was very interesting because it's The Son and the Star Spotlight on Hypnos, who will be showing up in that book come May 2nd. And this one wasn't quite as informative as the Amphithemis one. I think I got his name right. But Hypnos is pretty interesting nonetheless. His mother is Nyx. Remember how I said they keep mentioning Nyx in a lot of these articles? And now I'm starting to wonder if Nyx is going to play a big role in The Son and the Star. If I get that right, I would be very, very happy. Nyx is his mother, Morpheus is his son, Clovis is his demigod son, Thanatos, Eris, and Nemesis are his siblings, and Tartarus is his home. So, you know, got an interesting family there, got an interesting home life.
Yeah.
Who wants to stay in Tartarus? I have no idea. He put Zeus to sleep twice, which is definitely a feat.
Yeah.
To be able to do that with the king of the gods. And Zeus wasn't too happy about the first time. I guess the second time he didn't really know it was Hypnos. And then in the article it was like, hope Zeus isn't reading this. And I was like, that's kind of funny. And then Epiales, the demon of nightmares, will be teaming up with Hypnos in The Son and the Star. So that's a little ominous.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how I feel. Also, everybody was saying how attractive Hypnos was in the artwork that came with this article, and I have to agree. He is a very handsome-looking man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you really can.
He's got great cheekbones.
Right? Yes. He is quite beautiful. Yeah. But they said a lot about how Hypnos is kind of a chill god and how, you know, all of those other ones like Nemesis and Eris and all of them are supposed to be these like primordial deities that are neither good nor evil. We talked a lot about that with Nemesis, like not good or evil, just have their own prerogatives and it just kind of depends on how they're feeling, you know?
It's kind of like Morpheus, not necessarily bad, but tends to side with
gods
that are going to give him more power, which usually ends up being the bad guy. Yeah,
well, that's what they said too. Like Morpheus and Eris obviously is the goddess of discord, so there's a lot of bad things that kind of happen. Hypnos seems to be very neutral for the most part, but then Epiales, I don't know that I trust the demon of nightmares, so that's going to be kind of interesting.
Nightmares kind of side are on the side of things are terrible, so
yeah,
I'm not welcoming the god of a demon of nightmares.
Yeah, I dinner completely table. Agree. That would not make for a good meal,
no.
I don't think.
No.
So, not too much there, but something to think about. I think that's very interesting. We are obviously coming up on The Son and the Star very, very soon, so we will be talking about that a lot in the future, and I am very excited. I'm also very excited because apparently somebody found on a non-American Amazon site listings for two books that are coming out, one of which is a Lightning Thief tie-in edition with the TV series. Not too surprised that they would do that. They did one for the movie, so it makes sense that they would do one for the show.
And that's become pretty standard fare when something gets adapted these days. There's usually a movie or TV tie-in book, like, cover to kind of give... It lets people link the show with the book, I think, more than anything. Yeah. Like, people who aren't usually readers, if they go to Walmart and see the character as they see them on the cover, it's like, oh, now maybe I'll buy that book.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I think that's...
How cool would that be, though, Black Annabeth on it?
I know.
That would be so awesome. So, yeah, it will feature a cover with the kids. I'm assuming the trio, probably, or I mean, it could be just Walker.
I was going to say, it depends on how they want to do it. Yeah. Like, if they do, like, sometimes they'll do a movie tie-in where it's the cover, but they do it as, like, live action, so like it could be Walker in front of a wave, or like you know what I mean, like, or
like
they could go
creating the cover,
they could go kind of totally different and put the trio on, or him and Annabeth, or
that would be really cool if they did, though, because that would just be so exciting. It will also come with an 8-page photo insert with photos from the series, so I mean, I'm buying it. Like there was any question, but I'm definitely buying it.
Karen's like, yep, that's me. I'm right here.
Yeah. Apparently, there's also going to be a Camp Half-Blood Confidential sequel, which I found very interesting. I had seen the other one pop up, but I hadn't seen this one until this morning when I was searching for news. And it says, from the world of Percy Jackson Camp Half-Blood Confidential, your real guide to the demigod training camp. And I read through the blurb, and it will include information about the cabins, various landmarks, and training arenas, plus stories from heroes who have called Camp Half-Blood home or just passed through. Chiron introduces the book with a brief history of training based on his millennia of experience, plus pearls of wisdom from Apollo, because of course Apollo has to be involved.
Right.
But this is pretty cool. I mean, this has not been officially announced yet. This is just like an Amazon page right now on a non-US Amazon site. So I'm sure that it's real. They just haven't gotten around to like setting up the page yet.
Like, to be honest, they probably picked a non-US one to kind of play around with it, or to, you know, start getting things formatted or whatever, and they just assumed no one would find it.
Or somebody jumped the gun and put it up on that site, and
they were supposed
to hold it or something.
Underestimate the power of this fandom.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was pretty cool and something to look forward to. And that Lightning Thief tie-in edition apparently is supposed to be coming out in November, I think. So that's not that far away.
No.
Really. Good birthday present for me. Also, it has been 1 year since Walker was cast.
Wow.
Which feels like it went by really fast.
I mean, they shot the entire show.
Yeah.
In the whole first season in a year. I mean, I know that's pretty normal, but it doesn't, it feels like we raced through that. Like,
it's kind of, I mean, while we were in it, it was like, oh my god,
right?
The release date is so far away. But now that we're past like the actual filming, I just feel like things are coming. And
Yeah,
it's really exciting. I also wanted to talk about a quick interview with Timothy Omenson, who will be playing Hephaestus in the TV show. He was at a con recently, and somebody asked him about what it was like to be playing Hephaestus. And it's a short clip. I'll link to it. It's about 2 minutes long, but it was, like, very emotional, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts off with a joke by saying, well, Hephaestus is intensely handsome, because Timothy Omenson is a good-looking guy.
He really is.
And he gives great beard. I like it a lot.
He has very dramatic features.
He does, yeah.
So, like, I can see how some people may not agree, but I've always thought he was a very attractive man.
Yes.
Especially with the long hair and the beard. He just does the whole thing.
Yeah, I love the beard.
It just works.
Yeah. He said, it's gonna blow your effing minds. And the sets are like from a feature film. They are quality. There are top shelf actors, and Rick is making sure everything is perfect. Then he also tells this story about how Dan Schatz emailed him and was like, hey, we want you on this show. They did Jericho together. You know, what do you think? And Timothy responded and was like, look, the actor that you had 9 years ago is not the actor you have now, because, of course, he had a stroke. And he was talking about how he actually has a blind spot on his left side now, and he walks with a cane, and that on any given day, he doesn't really know how much mobility he has. And Dan responded with, "We want you however you are." And I was like, oh, no. Like, we talked about when he was cast how important it was for somebody, because Hephaestus obviously is a disabled god. His leg was crushed, and, you know, that is a part of his story.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they got somebody who has some mobility impairments is really important to bringing that character to life. But the more I just hear about it, and the more that it's, like, very much a forefront of, you know, them casting that character, makes me really happy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was getting all emotional. Yeah, but it was really cool, and I hope you guys actually watch and listen to it, because I just really like the way that he talks about the show and the character. Everybody has been just so excited about it, and I'm just... it's making me more excited.
I have a tiny little tangent, but it is related to the show.
Okay.
So, I may or may not have made a 10-year bet with my brother yesterday.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay.
All right. All right. I'm Team Kristen. That's all I know.
I love that. Okay, you will be. Trust me.
Yeah.
He texted me yesterday the news about the new HBO Max show. We've all heard about it. Whatever. And I said something like, they're just jealous that Disney Plus is putting together this massive Percy Jackson show that's going to change the world. And he was like, Kristen, the two fandoms don't begin to compare. Like, this other one is so much bigger. Like, Percy Jackson does not. And I said, excuse me. It's like, first of all, the only reason that I would agree that Harry Potter is slightly bigger is because they had a successful film franchise. Percy Jackson has managed to stay a massive franchise and get new readers without having a great series. They've had musicals, and they've done a million different adaptations of it. We've had graphic novels and whatever, but we've never seen it come alive on screen the way that Harry Potter did.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, first of all of the Percy Jackson fans are fans of the books. They're not just fans because they saw the thing. Now, we're finally getting an adaptation that's worth its weight. People are going to discover it through the show, new fans who have not read the books, and then I'm expecting to see this fandom just explode. Mm-hmm. I really am.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, Kristen, whatever, you know. Like, this is all just talk. You don't know. And I'm like, no. I fully expect it. And he goes, okay. I said something like, the only thing they're really missing besides an adaptation is a theme park. And he goes, well, that's never going to happen. And I said, oh, yeah, it will. Like, give them enough time, this fandom's going to take over. And he goes, okay, 10 years from now, if Percy Jackson has a theme park, I'll pay you $100.
Oh.
And he goes, and if they don't, you have to pay me $100. And I was like, all right, well, it better, like, I was like, it has to be a theme park, quote unquote, equal to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. It doesn't have to be its own standalone park, but it has to be a significant section of an existing park. And he goes, not just one ride. No Tiana's Wild Ride thing going on here. You can't just have one ride and call that it. I was like, no, it will be a whole ass theme park, I promise you. And he's like, okay. And I'm like, Disney built Pandora and nobody likes Avatar, so trust me. I was like, so trust me, it's gonna happen. So, 10 years from now.
Yeah.
There better be.
Avatar is also like a $1 billion franchise. Just saying.
So, I thought it was hilarious, and I immediately thought of a podcast and was like, yeah, I can't wait to tell everybody about this
bet.
It's gonna be funny, and I am going to lord it over him when it actually happens.
I hope it does. Part of me is like, oh my god, is 10 years enough time? But, like, I think it's 5 seasons of the show by then, so we're definitely...
We'll see.
All right, we gotta talk to some people. Kristen cannot lose this bet, you guys.
I'm thoroughly amused by this. I don't know if he'll remember it 2 years from now, let alone 10.
Well,
if it doesn't happen,
don't say anything.
I've documented it here because
does happen, we will remember.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so this is the episode where Kristen made a bet.
Oh, no. $100 isn't too bad. But it's the pride. I know her brother, and, like, I get it. I want to win.
Oh, I know. Well, and my boyfriend believes that I'm wrong, and I told him...
He should support you anyway.
I told him that that's blasphemy, but it's going to be fine, because we all know what's coming, so...
I'm Team Kristen.
That's right.
Yeah, we're the only ones that matter. Okay, let's talk about Egyptian mythology in pop culture. We did this before for Greek mythology and had a lot of really cool things to talk about, movies and TV shows and that sort of thing. And I was really excited to dive into this because it's not as prevalent as Greek mythology, even though there actually are a lot of different properties out there that deal with it. I feel like it doesn't quite hit that, like, mainstream level that Greek mythology does sometimes. Other than a few major movies / franchises that we will get to, obviously.
Yes.
But I was actually really, really excited to dive into this, and I discovered some things that I didn't realize were quite connected to Egyptian mythology, so that was very exciting for me.
I also learned some fun facts about some movies I thought I knew everything about.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh... That's kind of interesting. So, yeah, we all learned things.
That's cool. Well, why don't you go first, kick us off. What's the first Egyptian mythology and pop culture entity that you have?
Okay, so first off, I have to say, these first two especially, maybe even the third one, don't really have mythology, like Egyptian mythology, as the heart of them.
Okay.
But they take place in Egypt, and there's enough references to things that are... Egypt mythology adjacent.
Like cultural stuff? Because a lot of that is tied together anyway.
Yeah. So it's like, the first movie I have is The Ten Commandments, which, you know, it's been around for a million years. It stars Yul Brynner and Charlton Heston. My family, we used to watch it every Easter because it was always on TBS or TNT or one of those. Every year, it's like a 3.5-4-hour movie. It used to be the only, like, 3.5-4-hour movie. Like, you didn't watch it a million times a year because it was so long.
Yeah.
Now it feels like every movie and their mom is 3 hours long. But,
Your mom is 3 hours long.
So yeah, Ten Commandments. It's an adaptation of the Bible story of Moses, basically from his birth to his death / parting of the earth, whatever. But like, yeah, this is probably the oldest property we're going to talk about. It's an Easter classic. It's... basically, it's obviously based in Christian ideology. It's based on the story from the Bible. It takes place almost entirely in Egypt because he is born to his mother, who puts him in a basket and sends him down the river because she is afraid for his life because the Pharaoh is killing children in order to save him his own power.
Mm.
And so his mother puts him in a basket. She's Hebrew. The queen finds him in this basket, saves him, and raises him as her own son.
Oh.
So he's a prince of Egypt.
I'm sorry, I don't know this.
It's fine.
So I'm fascinated
right now. No, it's totally fine. So he is raised as a prince, mm-hmm. as a prince of Egypt. And the pharaoh that in the story he fights against, like, that is his main antagonist, is his brother. Like,
oh.
Ramses II is raised alongside Moses in I don't know technically if we know it's Ramses II, but in the movie they have named him Ramses
II.
So,
okay.
Yeah, so they're raised alongside each other, and I would say given equal-ish weight, but obviously there's something about Moses that drew her to keep him and raise him. So, like, mm-hmm. for some reason, he kind of gets favored a little, and the other brother is not exactly thrilled with that news. But anyway, Moses is trying to free his Hebrew people from the Egyptians because they have been keeping them as slaves. So the whole movie is about basically Moses freeing his people and the whole story of parting the Red Sea and all that stuff. So yeah, that's basically the movie. But like it takes place in Egypt, so you're seeing that iconography, and I feel like this is one of the first times we're seeing Egypt on screen. Like, some of the older movies, especially black and white, I think a few of them did have some Egyptian themes, or they dove into mythology a little. But, like, in color and getting the full, like, set dressing of Egypt.
Yeah.
It's the old Hollywood version of Egypt, mm-hmm. so it's very...
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
It's not necessarily accurate. We'll put it that way. It's not necessarily culturally accurate or, like, texturally accurate. Like, I don't know if they had as many drapes draping around. lot of, like, random drapery and really pretty banisters, and I'm like, I don't know if that's technically, like, a thing. Because it's Egypt. I don't know. But yeah, but it's set in Egypt, and it definitely gives you a feel for, like, Egyptian, parts of Egyptian culture. It's definitely not, like, a, I would not use it as a cultural reference, because Yul Brynner is Russian.
Okay.
Definitely not Egyptian, okay. Playing the Egyptian pharaoh.
And I feel like we have to mention this, because that happens a lot when, you know, you're getting Egyptian movies and all that kind of stuff. They whitewash those characters a lot. Is definitely a thing.
Yeah. I think there's a movie called Gods of Egypt, which we are not talking about today, that I think has Christian Bale as an Egyptian. Like, it happens a lot.
Gerard Butler's in that, I think.
It happens a lot. It's unfortunate. Hopefully we're getting to a better time where we can let people represent their people.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than just whitewashing everything. But yeah, so it's definitely evident in this, but still, you know, it's still an interesting film. It doesn't have to be... We can understand its faults while still appreciating what it gave us. But yeah, it doesn't necessarily have a ton of mythology in it, but even when I was Googling, like, trying to get ideas of other films we could talk about today, this one kept coming up, like, over and over and over again. So it is considered, like, a movie with Egyptian mythology, despite the fact that there isn't a ton of actual mythology in the movie. I did think it was funny. The Egyptian authorities were happy to let Cecil B. DeMille, who is the director of Ten Commandments, they were happy to let him shoot there due to his portrayal of Arabs in The Crusades, which was an earlier movie of his.
Okay.
They were so happy to have been put on screen and not made a caricature of themselves, I think. Like, I don't think he did them dirty. He did his best to represent them as people.
Which is probably something that never happened back then.
And they were so happy about The Crusades that they welcomed him in and said, you treated us well, so well, you may do anything here you want. So, and they shot mostly on a soundstage, but they did do some specific scenes and things in Egypt proper. So, like... I thought that was really cool.
That is really interesting. That's not a movie that I've seen before, and obviously not super familiar with the story. But I, you know, I'm sure that it does have a lot of hang-ups because of old Hollywood and that sort of thing. But at the same time, like, stories like that are nice, that you can kind of see that camaraderie from back then as well. My first one is obviously The Mummy. It's the first one that came to mind for me. It is a classic. It is a favorite of both Kristen and I, and I would assume that probably everyone listening to this podcast has seen it, at least in part. If not, definitely go watch it. I rewatched it recently. I mean, I've seen that movie 100 times. I can literally quote it. Like,
it's been a while, and I really want to get back.
I can quote it so much, and so I really wanted to watch it. This was a while ago. For some reason, I really wanted to watch it. My boyfriend had seen it and was just like, eh, like, it's not my favorite movie, and I put it on. I was enraptured still. Like, I still couldn't, like, it wasn't just a background movie. Like, I was sitting there watching it, and I was, like, quoting it, and he's like, you've really seen this movie a lot, haven't you? I was like, yes, it's so good. How do you not love this movie?
I just remember when it came out, and it was, like, it was this fun take on an Egyptian adventure movie. Like, I think everybody expected it to be kind of like Indiana Jones, but it was funnier. It was, you know, just as intense as any, you know, obviously, honestly, more intense based with the magic and all of that going on, too. But, like, I don't know, something about Brendan Fraser just made it that much funnier.
Yeah, he's so good in that movie. And it probably... is, I would assume, because I think I got my interest in Greek mythology from Disney's Hercules, because that's always been my favorite movie. I'm pretty sure that this kicked off my interest in Egyptian mythology, too. And, you know, even though I'm not as familiar with it, I definitely recognize a lot of things in the King Chronicles and a lot of things just in general because of The Mummy. I liked it because we got a glimpse of ancient Egypt in the past, like, there are flashbacks, and also fast forward to, like, what it looks like now, so you can see how things, there's that shot where, like, you kind of see the Sphinx getting ruined and stuff like that, like, being built, and then it, like, flash forwards to, like, its nose is broken off and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure the flashbacks to ancient Egypt are not super accurate. I know there's probably still a lot of inaccuracies there. I don't know how many drapes were draping.
I know,
I don't remember in the movie if there's a lot of drapes draping, but
I don't know why that's a thing that sticks out in my brain. And maybe there aren't even that many drapes, but for some reason my brain remembers there being all kinds of drapes. And I remember in The Mummy that there's a drape that you see her shadow through at one point, so I know there's at least one drape in
The
Mummy.
That's true. Podcast of drapes. We're going to become a drape podcast.
Talking about the draperies.
Yeah. Not to be confused with a Drake podcast, which would be very different.
Very different.
Anyway, so this is also probably why I love archaeology, and I very, very seriously wanted to become an archaeologist. That was like, okay, writing was definitely my first, like, choice career path, and then I wanted it to be archaeology, and then that transformed into, well, I took a sidestep into, like, crime scene investigation, like, forensics
and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, everybody did.
We all considered it.
And then I came back around to art history, but archaeology is, like, one of my first loves.
I was gonna say, it's so close to academia that I could understand how writing and archaeology you kind of fall into one section, especially if mythology is really interesting to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that all fits. That all makes sense.
Yeah. And in The Mummy, there are lots of discussions about the gods and about these, like, kind of legendary things. So you have the Statue of Anubis, which plays a big part in the movie, the Book of the Dead, the Book of Amun-Ra. We've talked about Amun-Ra, and now we know even more about him. It also had a lot of cultural things, like mummification and curses and that sort of thing. And at the end of the movie, you know, spoiler alert, I guess, from this movie from 1999, Imhotep's immortality is stripped at the end by Anubis because he's, you know, a god of the dead. And so there's just, like, I really like that it's got this modern-day cultural aspect to it, but also a lot of the ancient stuff kind of mixed in there as well. And a lot of it kind of comes to life with Imhotep in this movie.
Along with a healthy dose of, we shouldn't have opened that thing, a 2000s tale. Yeah. We should have opened that sarcophagus.
Do not read from the book. It's one of my favorite lines in the movie.
You're on the wrong side of the river. Yeah. That's the other one that sticks in my head.
I know. Yeah. Oh, it's so good. Oh, man. So, okay. There are three movies in this original franchise. The second one, also very good. The third one, I'm sorry, cannot talk about it. It's got some great people in it, including Michelle Yeoh. But even she couldn't save it for me. It's been a long time since I watched it.
I don't think I've actually seen the third one.
Yeah.
I've seen the first two. I don't think I saw the third one.
Yeah, I mean, they changed who plays Evie, so, like, I could never forgive them for that.
Nope.
She probably decided not to based on the script, but I still couldn't forgive it. The Mummy reboot exists. We don't really talk about it. I will say that it's probably a little better done in terms of, like, possibly cultural aspects and stuff. I really liked that the mummy was a woman, too. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But
it's not our favorite.
Yeah, it's not great. And then there's the Scorpion King movies, which I don't know if I realized there were three movies in this franchise. I definitely watched the first one and remember, like, I know it's not great, I remember liking it. Those two things usually go hand in hand for me. I tend to like terrible movies. I know that the CGI of The Rock as the Scorpion King, not good. Not good at all.
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, and I don't know anything about the other movies, but that also exists. I can't speak to that because I don't really remember it at all.
It's out there in the world.
Yes.
Okay, so this takes me to my second one, which, funny enough, is another incarnation of the Moses story. The Bible has a lot of things that relate to Egypt, because Egypt and Israel and all of those areas that are so, you know, it's where all of those early man stories come from. It's all from that area of the world. So it makes sense that you're going to get a lot of references to Egypt in Bible stories and things like that. Okay, so first of all, Prince of Egypt, I think everyone assumes it's a Disney movie. It was made by DreamWorks.
Oh, okay.
So it was in that era of, like, Shrek and things, like, when those movies came out. And it kind of falls in line with, like, Anastasia, where people, it's so good, and it's an animated movie, and it kind of is based on, like, an old tale that people assume that it was Disney, but it's not.
It's kind of a classic, so you just assume Disney. Yeah. Because they have most of the classics under their belt.
But it was definitely made by DreamWorks. It is, again, another telling of the Moses story, which, you know, is what Ten Commandments is all about, too. But it's animated, it's got music, it's, you know, it's different. I think a lot more people our age have probably seen Prince of Egypt than have seen Ten Commandments.
I've also not seen this one.
It's very old.
But I've definitely, like, I recognize the imagery and stuff.
Yeah. I didn't find a whole lot to talk about new, because it's the same story, so you're going to hit the same kind of cultural items here and there. But one thing I did want to talk about, that you already mentioned, actually, with the mummy, is the Sphinx losing its nose. And pop culture has this fascination with explaining how old architecture that is iconic and that sort of thing, they have this tendency to try and explain, like, how it got there. Like, there are movies that talk about how the Tower of Pisa started to lean.
That's true.
Stuff like that. Yeah. So this idea of the Sphinx being whole, and at some point it lost its nose, and incorporating that into your movie, it's one of those things. So we get that in Prince of Egypt. You talked about it in The Mummy.
Yeah.
There's a scene, you know, a moment where you kind of see how the Sphinx loses its
nose. That was just it, like, rubbed away over the years, basically.
It definitely happens in Aladdin.
Okay.
They're flying by on the carpet, and they distract him, and the guy hits the thing, and the nose breaks.
Oh, I do remember that.
So, like, it's a thing that happens over and over again. Prince of Egypt has one. The two brothers are chariot racing, and they run into something, and it causes the nose to be severed off, and that's how the Sphinx lost its nose. We all know that it was probably, I actually read up a teensy bit about this, it was probably done by someone who culturally was trying to protest things that were going on at the time he was alive. And so it probably wasn't just from deterioration, it probably was vandalized, and that's why it doesn't have its nose. But they don't know that for certain, so it's not something that people talk about. But it was one of those, I just thought it was really interesting that this one very iconic figure in Egyptian culture, the Sphinx, that we know what it is, we know when you see it, you know what it is, but this tale of how it lost its nose has become a recurring theme in pop culture.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure there's an old animated movie called The Chipmunk Adventure that I've talked about before. I'm pretty sure in that movie, like, they talk about the nose or something. Like, that takes place in, like, a current day back in the 90s, so it couldn't have fallen off then, but I swear they talk about it or something, because I know they go through Egypt at one point.
That was 30 years ago.
I know. Ancient days.
Yeah. It's vintage now.
But yeah, so Prince of Egypt is another movie that does represent that time period of, you know, ancient Egypt, kind of gives you an idea of what that could have been like. But it doesn't really have anything crazy different from Ten Commandments.
Right, yeah. My next pick is a lot more recent because it's Moon Knight, which of course is the Marvel property. You can watch it on Disney Plus. It stars Oscar Isaac, who is phenomenal in the role. He plays two different people, and it's just very, very good the way that it's done. And the way they bring Egyptian mythology into the real world made a lot of sense. And when I watched it, we were still reading Percy Jackson, but I got so excited to read the Kane Chronicles because I was looking at it and I was like, this is how it should be done. This is like bringing these stories to life and making them very real was amazing. And I feel like it could really kind of set a precedent for people being more interested in Egyptian mythology and to get more people excited for the Kane Chronicles adaptation, because if they see, okay, Moon Knight had this stuff that I thought was pretty cool, yes, that's more adult than Kane Chronicles will be, but it's still going to be a live action Egyptian mythology film. So I'm hoping that there'll be some crossover audience. And especially with them, especially with them being on Disney Plus, but Kane Chronicles is Netflix, I was like, they could have grouped them together on Disney and promoted them both.
I have not watched Moon Knight. I know. It's one of my secret shames. Are they doing another season of that? Or was it kind of a one and done?
Okay. No, I believe there'll be a second season.
That's exciting then, because like, if that continues to kind of keep, you know, interest and keep people kind of involved, then
And yeah. It was a very chaotic but very good show, and it kind of takes you a minute to really understand what's going on. And I think part of that, too, is that it mentions a lot of gods that are less familiar. So, like, even though Osiris and Anubis and Horus and all that kind of stuff, like, that's there. Like, the main ones that you really see are Khonshu, who is the god of the moon and the passing of time, Ammit, who's, this is a wild one, four quarters of a lion, hind quarters of a hippo, and the head of a crocodile. Ammit was not worshipped, but rather was considered a guardian demon and was involved in the judgment of the dead.
I find this interesting.
Why?
Considering the chapter.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. And then also Taweret, who was a hippo fertility goddess. And this one really, you get to see the hippo goddess in person. And it's all CGI, obviously. But it was just really well done. And it just felt very colorful and alive and present. And it's... Honestly, Moon Knight made me feel how Percy Jackson and the Caine Chronicles make me feel. Like, the gods are real and present, but, like, just out of reach, just beyond mortals' touch, and yet still, like, influencing the world. So I would say that, especially if you are slightly older, I don't think Moon Knight is, like, particularly graphic or anything, but I think it is more for, like, a slightly older audience than the Caine Chronicles. But if that's your jam and you haven't watched it yet, 100% do, because especially if you really like the Caine Chronicles, I think there's good crossover potential there.
Yes, and I do need to watch this series, and I will work on
it. Yes, and then talk to me about it.
Yes, yes, I swear. Okay, so the next movie on my list is Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark. Honestly, all of Indiana Jones movies take place kind of in desert climes, or at least at some point. So it would make sense to just kind of include them all under one umbrella. But Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark specifically deals with the Ark of the Covenant, which is, again, another, like, biblical item, something that's talked about in the Bible. But it's... That's, like, just knowing what it is basically the most, like... biblical part of this. The majority of this is talking about the Nazis that want the Ark of the Covenant because they think it's going to give them power, and they're idiots, basically. Yeah. But
is this the first movie?
Yes.
Okay. I know I've watched all the Indiana Jones movies once a long time ago. I do not really remember them.
Yeah, this is the first one. It came out in 1981. So it kind of sets the scene for the Indiana Jones movies going forward. But there is specifically one scene where it's like this map room that they hold the staff of Ra. And they had to find the special, like, top piece, the headpiece for the Staff of Ra. And once you put it on, and you put it in a certain spot in the room, it highlights areas of the map where the Ark of the Covenant is. So, okay. Like, you see this whole world kind of unfold on the floor. It's like a 3D rendering of the area around them and all that. So, it's a really cool room. Plus, you get to see the hieroglyphics on the wall. And, like, it's a kind of a temple. They call it the map room at Tanis. I believe Tanis is a room of this, like, temple.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, it's a just a really interesting way to kind of look at archaeology and their, you know, it's obviously fictional, but, like, their look at Egypt and how an archaeologist would deal with situations like this. Yes, it involves Nazis. Yes, they fight the Nazis. The Nazis do dumb things. All fine in my book. As long as Indiana Jones is fighting Nazis, the world is fine. But yeah, a large portion of the film takes place in Egypt because of all of the looking for the covenant and knowing that it's in one of these Egyptian areas. And yeah, I mean, that's basically the majority of it. But it does have some, like, pretty... The Staff of Ra is another, you know... It gives you that link to mythology, and they talk about Ra in the movie, like, kind of getting an idea of why this is significant, why, you know, they would be looking for it, all of that.
So. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I like that. I think I would like to revisit those movies at some point, especially because I watched Shrinking on Apple Plus, and Harrison Ford is a delight in that show.
Absolute delight.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite lovely. And so now I'm like, oh, do I like you now? Because I was very neutral on him before. Oh, and yeah. I was like,
Air Force One. Go back and watch that again.
I do love Air Force One.
Go back and watch that again, because I love him in that one. Yeah. And yeah, Indiana Jones is another great series for him. Yeah. And even Han Solo, he's great in those two. But yeah, I personally have an affection for Indiana Jones. My brothers were obsessed with Star Wars. They, you know, especially Steven, he was obsessed with Indiana Jones. He had a little blue string purse that my mom used to, like, it was old, that my mom gave us for dress up, that he claimed as his Indiana Jones adventures bag. So, like, he kept, like, his archaeology supplies.
Oh my God,
and, like,
that's so
he would
cute.
Put a backpack on his back and go out in the backyard and run around and pretend he had a little fedora that he'd wear.
Oh my
and, yeah. My brother was obsessed with Indiana Jones. He went as Indiana Jones for Halloween a couple of times. We watched those movies a lot, except for Temple of Doom, because my mom thought it was too scary, so we weren't allowed to watch that one. But we watched Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Isn't that arguably the worst one? No, not Temple of Doom. Crystal Skull? That's the one people don't like, right?
It's the newer one. Yeah. That it's not great.
Yeah.
But the newest one that's coming out next year looks good, so I'm interested to see what that has.
Cautiously neutral about it. I had no interest, and then I watched Shrinking, and I was like, maybe I have to watch Indiana Jones now.
The newest trailer for it looks better than any of the other ones. I wasn't, like, bullish about it. I was like, the last movie burned me, so whatever.
Yeah.
But the newer one looks interesting.
And Phoebe Waller-Bridge is in it from Fleabag. Yeah.
Yes. Amongst other things.
Yes. Yes. But that's the big one. Okay. I'm going to talk about a book series now.
Ooh.
Because this book series was quite a big one for me. I was obviously a big Animorphs fan. I don't know why I'm saying obviously. Maybe it's just like the aura that I give off. I feel like a lot of people our age loved Animorphs.
I was going to say, I feel like we've talked about Animorphs before. Yeah.
Yeah. So Kay Applegate also wrote another series called Everworld. And I think I've actually mentioned this as well. And this was a slightly older audience than Animorphs, but it hit on a lot of the same themes. And basically the premise is every time the main characters fall asleep in the real world, they wake up in Everworld. And when they fall asleep in Everworld, they wake up back in the real world. Do they ever get any sleep? I don't know. But Everworld is this universe where, like, everything exists. So you have Greek gods, Egyptian gods, Norse gods, fairies, Aztec gods, knights, mermaids, like everything exists in this other world.
Interesting.
And I honestly don't remember many specifics from the books, but I did make sure that there were Egyptian mythology, there were some stuff in there. And I think there's one book in particular that might like deal with that a little more closely. I don't remember that. And I'm pretty sure I read the last book because I'm very sure I remember what happens at the end and being like, what the, as a kid.
Yeah.
But I don't remember a lot of it. I do remember it being kind of scary when I read it. And the idea that all of these gods and legendary heroes live together in the same universe was obviously, like, pretty cool that you could just run into any of them at any time.
Yeah.
The book I remember the most is Realm of the Reaper, and it has Hel on the cover, H-E-L.
Yeah.
And she has, like, a half-living, half-dead face. And that just freaked me out as a kid. And, yeah, she really scared me. But when I read Magnus Chase, I thought back to that because it's all related. It's Norse mythology. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I really, really want to reread this series as an adult because I feel like it's probably pretty cool. I don't know how much it holds up. If anybody's read it recently, let me know. But I would be... They're small books, too. And I think I still have most of them.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't give up that series. That was one of the ones that I had to keep. But yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Mix it up a little, not just movies and TV.
Yeah.
We got some books in there, too. The last one that I wanted to talk about is Night at the Museum, which there is no true, real, non-fictionalized Egyptian mythology in this movie. So I'm just going to say that right now, because I did not know that. I thought Akhmenra was possibly an actual, like, Egyptian prince or something.
Oh,
I did not know that it was entirely fictional.
Oh, okay.
They based Akhmenra on Tutankhamun.
Okay.
Who we all have heard about the mummy Tutankhamun, King Tut, whatever. So they did use a lot of the details from Tutankhamun's story to kind of map out Akhmenra's story, but they created a whole character. Honestly, I think it might have been out of respect because they did a lot of things right with including Egyptian cultural ideas and things in these movies. And they may not have wanted to, like, represent an actual figure, so they created their own so that they could take, you know, story license and do what they wanted to do with the character.
I'm sorry I keep laughing because I keep thinking about your pronunciation of Tutankhamun is very good, but then we call him King Tut, but I guess the alternative would be King Tut. So I just kept thinking about and I couldn't stop laughing.
So, we are actually five, in case anybody's curious.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's hilarious, and I like it. One of the main points of contrast is there is no explanation for Tutankhamun's death. They don't know his cause of death, or at least they didn't when they made the film.
Okay.
They created this whole story about Akhmenra and his brother and all of that. It was not a part of the thing. But, worth noting, Rami Malek, who plays Akhmenra, is culturally Egyptian. His father, I believe, is from Cairo, worked in Cairo.
Yeah.
I believe his mother is also Egyptian, and, like, they were raised with, I forget the exact, like, words for it, but it's, like, Egyptian Coptic something or other.
Oh, okay. I've heard of that.
Where, like, they have cultural and religious beliefs that are tied to their culture.
Right.
So, he is definitely actually Egyptian, and I think I give a lot of credit to the filmmakers for allowing someone who actually has some knowledge to play the character, and also give some credit to Rami Malek for wanting to do that, especially in a movie where it's being played for a joke, but, like, not insensitively.
Right.
Because it's the Museum of Natural History, like, it is a place that's talking about the history, but, like, they're also, it's a kid's movie, so it's for fun, and they're, you know, all of that.
I wonder if this might be the only person, or this is the only property that might actually have Egyptian people in it, because I'm not sure.
At least that is widely known.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I don't know about The Mummy specifically, if there were any other characters.
It's possible. I mean, I don't know, In the sequel, they cast Hank Azaria, who is very much not Egyptian, as his brother. Mostly, I think, because Hank Azaria is kind of a master. He loves doing voices and creating these over-the-top characters, and he's done it time and time and time again on film. So I think they were playing the laugh. It's for kids. They wanted an actor who was going to really just be over-the-top, and I think that's why he ended up in this role. But he plays Akhmenra's brother, Khamenra, and we get into more of this brother story here that, again, is all concocted for the movie. But there are, like, at least, like, iconography-wise, you can see a lot of that Egyptian influence, and it feels like it could be an exhibit in the, you know, Natural History Museum and all of that.
Right,
so,
yeah.
Also worth noting, just because we have talked about the 90s mummy, Hank Azaria actually modeled his voice and his lisp as Khamenra after Boris Karloff's performance of the mummy from the 1932 original The Mummy. So I thought that was, like, at least he did something. Like, he didn't, it's not necessarily culturally Egyptian thing, but he looked at portrayals of these, you know, of Egyptian characters and said, I'm going to at least take a Hollywood-esque version of it. And, you know.
That's interesting. I did look up The Mummy, by the way. There are no ethnic Egyptians in The Mummy. The guy who plays the curator is Indian-American, which is, like, obviously not the same thing.
No.
But that's all they basically said about that. I find that really interesting, and I think anybody who, I guess I could have added the original Mummy on here as well, because I've actually seen it. I watched all of the Universal Monster movies a couple of years ago with all of the original, like, The Invisible Man, Frankenstein, which was actually pretty good, and all of those, so they're pretty cool if you like to watch old movies, or at least don't mind watching old movies. But yeah, that's really interesting. The last one on my list is kind of just really short and simple because I don't know much about it, but I've seen both Shazam and Black Adam, And I did not realize it. So I knew that in Shazam, Shazam actually stands for Solomon, Hercules, Atlas, Zeus, Achilles, and Mercury.
Yeah.
So obviously a lot of them are, well, I would say, like, you know, Solomon is an outlier, but Mercury is Hermes, but they had to use an M.
Right.
They couldn't use another H.
Yeah.
Shazam.
Well, plus I think maybe they also did that to kind of incorporate a bit of the Roman, so it's
possibly
not strictly Greek.
Right.
Plus Solomon is kind of more biblical, so it's right. You never know where that's going to fit in.
Yeah.
It could be Hebrew, it could be whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, that's kind of...
But I thought that was really interesting. I did not realize that Black Adam is actually the Egyptian side of this. So he also says Shazam to get his powers.
Okay.
But for him, Shazam stands for Shu, the god of air, Heru, which is basically Horus, Amun, which is Amun-Ra, Zehuti, who is Thoth, and Aton, who is a sun god, and then Mehen, who is a cosmic serpent. And I actually found this fascinating because we talked a lot about how the Egyptians influenced the Greeks and how sometimes, like, they are the same, like Thoth and Hermes were kind of thought to be the same person, just in different forms. And the fact that Shazam and Black Adam and all of that is the same thing is, like, kind of nuts to me. I didn't realize that, and I find it really, really interesting.
Yeah. I haven't seen Black Adam yet, so I'll kind of, like, keep an eye out.
It's pretty good. It's not the best, but it's pretty good.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I don't need it to be. I don't need it to be amazing.
Yeah.
But no, I'll keep an eye out for that, just to kind of see if there are any hidden references or things that I may not have caught otherwise.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So that was Egyptian mythology in pop culture. If you've got any other recommendations or things that we missed or ones that you want us or that you want to talk about more or you want us to talk about more, let us know. We're always down to talk about pop culture things. Obviously, we try to fit it in whenever we can because we love talking about that.
Oh, yeah.
But this week, we are talking about the King Chronicles Chapter 6, which was a doozy.
Yes, it was.
So, take it away, Kristen.
Even my recap is slightly longer than my other brief recaps. So, here's this week's. Finally, some explanations. The Cains and the Fausts are ancient Egyptian families who still study the magic of the gods. Carter's head restless sleep sends him to Phoenix and back with all kinds of details about what the fireman is planning next. Okay, so, digging into this chapter, we left the last chapter with Carter choosing to go to bed and put the headrest on the floor, and we quickly see that this may have had some effect on his quality
of sleep. Which you called. You were like, that means something.
Yeah, no, clearly. But yeah, so he, immediately upon falling asleep, or pretty close to it, he discovers that he's floating above his body, and that he doesn't have arms anymore, he has wings.
Yes.
And
he's a little chicken man.
And Sadie keeps calling him a chicken, and he's like, that's not, chickens don't fly, Sadie, come on. I love it. It's so cute.
It is prophecy count number 33.
I would say it counts,
yeah. Our first prophecy of the Cain Chronicles.
Woohoo! I love that. Totally love that. But yeah, so he departs the world, kind of.
Temporarily.
We learn later that this is actually the Duat, which I'll explain exactly what the Duat is as we get to it later in the chapter when Amos tells us. But he enters the lowest, like, level, the very shallow level of the Duat, and it travels him across the United States to Phoenix, where he basically just stops and is watching kind of from a distance these two creature people?
That's a good description for them.
One that looks kind of toad-like and definitely has, like, green slimy skin, but still must appear human-esque because Carter identifies him as being, like, a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is a man with a red, wet head, I believe is how he described it, which he didn't look at too closely, and I wouldn't want
I'm
to
glad.
Either. But has, like, rooster-esque feet, so he calls them rooster and toad, basically.
Yeah.
Which is fine with me.
Yeah.
That's enough for me to identify them. But yeah, so we see that this fireman, the antagonist of this book so far, the series so far, I don't know. He shows up, and basically, they're wanting an update on what happened, and Fire Guy lets them know. And this is very generic in the way he says it, but I know that's on purpose, Rick. I know it. he says one is already entombed, which we kind of believe would be Julius, right, and therefore Osiris.
Right.
Which we kind of already know.
Yeah.
The second is weak. She will be easily manipulated. That leaves only two, and they will be dealt with soon enough. So I'm guessing we know that there were five gods released, because he said that while he was there. There, I'm guessing, are four that are fighting those five, that he wants to make sure those four are taken care of. That's what it sounds like.
I'm still a little... Well, because Osiris came out when this other guy came out, so, like...
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Is there only five in general, or are there nine, like, four and five?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I think there's five that are on Fire Dude's side.
Okay.
Julius did not know that these five were imprisoned where Osiris was.
Right.
So when he bonded with Osiris and pulled him out of the Rosetta Stone, these other five were released as well. That's my interpretation.
Yeah.
So that leaves five baddies, and then you've got these four others. I don't necessarily know if they're good, because later on in the chapter we learn that all of the gods are kind of
not great.
Troublemakers.
Yeah.
So, I don't necessarily know if they're good, but they're at least opposing forces for the five that we're currently afraid of. So, yeah. My, just throwing my hat in the ring for a guess, the second is weak. She will be easily manipulated. Definitely sounds like a reference to Muffin. I'm just saying, because I already believe and will not be deterred that Muffin is a god, and I'm pretty sure it's Bast, and I would not leave it to a man to underestimate Bast. So we'll just leave it at that. So yeah, he goes on to dissolve Toad Guy into nothing because he has power and this guy's annoying him, so he does that. And then he talks about how he's going to build his temple on this mountain, Mount Camelback, outside of Phoenix. And when it is complete, he will summon the greatest storm ever known. And then later on, right at the end of the chapter, he mentions that it will be a great birthday present. So, by the time this dude has his birthday, he's going to bring a giant storm down upon the world, the United States. I couldn't really tell, but it's going to be bad.
Yeah, it's not going to be great.
Okay, so then the rooster dude kind of chimes in and says, like, Carter couldn't quite make it out, but he basically was kind of arguing his case, and Fireman gets really excited and says, collect the younglings and bring them to me. I want them alive before they have time to learn their powers. And I love that there is no parsing here. Carter knows this is talking about them. He addresses it as soon as he's back in his real body. So yeah, definitely trying to hedge off this possibility of having an opposing force in the Kane children.
Yeah. I thought that this prophecy slash vision thing, I mean, we later learned that he very much, like, was there and that he witnessed it.
Yeah.
But we still count those as prophecies. But I thought it was really interesting in general. It does harken back to a lot of Percy Jackson dreams and that sort of thing. So that was pretty cool. I was really interested when Carter said that he normally dreams in black and white, because I was like, is that a thing? And apparently it is. I went down a rabbit hole about dreaming in black and white. 12% of people dream in black and white. And there's this really interesting article on Medium, so, like, take that with a grain of salt. I don't know how great they are about vetting their writers, but there were some studies mentioned in there about how back in, like, Aristotle and Plato's days, they referenced dreaming in color, and then come about the 1900s, when black and white films started to come out, more people dreamed in black and white. And then in the 1960s, when Technicolor TV came out, more people started saying that they dreamed in color. There are some, like, issues with the studies and how they collected their data and everything like that, but I know for a fact I dream in color. I'd never even considered dreaming in black and white because I have very vivid, interesting dreams that I often remember, which is super common, but
I've remembered more of my dreams lately than I have in a long time. And I would say I believe I dream in color, too.
Yeah.
I'm not remembering dreaming in black and white, but I'm sure it probably could and maybe has happened.
Yeah.
You know, you never know. But I find that interesting and kind of fascinating that if you consume media that's in black and white, then your mind may replay or create worlds that are black and white in your dreams. Like, it makes logical sense if that's what you're taking in every day. Like, I would wonder if, like, film historians who watch a lot of black and white film, if they dream in, like, black and white.
If there's a higher percentage of them.
If that it really does affect how you see things in your dreams.
So interesting.
The brain is a crazy organ. It's nuts.
And Gracie Kim is supposed to be writing that story about dreams, remember? Yeah. I am, like, really needing this book soon because I know she's doing a lot of research for it, so I'm so interested.
Yeah. But, yeah, so then Carter wakes up back in his body.
With a cat on his chest, which I definitely know that feeling.
I like to believe that Muffin noticed what was going on and maybe tried to ground him so that he could find his way back. Like, obviously it could just be a cat thing, but I think Muffin was trying to help Carter, like, come back to himself, because he doesn't travel back. He just wakes up and he's in his body and he's there and Muffin's on his chest. So I like to believe that that was Muffin looking out for him. Okay, so brief mention about their clothes. Both Sadie and Carter are wearing the same basic thing. Carter's clothes are gone, and so he's wearing what is available in the closet that is all in his size, and it's plain white linen, drawstring pants, and loose shirts with robes for cold weather. I just find it really interesting. He knows that this is what the fellaheen wear, which is, like, a term for peasants in Egypt, and I'm fascinated that, like, they have the type of deodorant they want. They have all of their favorite snacks, but heaven forbid we give you a t-shirt and shorts to wear while you're in this house of life. Like, I don't know if it's significant. I don't know if later on it's gonna play a role or something. I don't know. Yeah. But I just think it's fascinating that they can have,
that's, you know, a really good point,
Pringles
though.
And Doritos and Speed Stick in the bathroom, but you have to wear this white linen.
Yeah.
I don't know. We do get into Carter explaining why he dresses the way he does, which this is a very, honestly, serious and sincere moment from him where he's talking about wanting to wear a t-shirt and shorts as a kid because he's hot and they're, you know, spending all their time in Egypt and in these really warm places. And his father tells him that he is a black man and that people are going to treat him differently and look at him differently immediately upon seeing him. So he must always dress to impress and dress his best because that will, like, soften their initial judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we all know that this is definitely prevalent. This, you know, we know that this is true.
Yeah.
But to have to hear that as a child, he couldn't even wear a t-shirt and shorts because his dad knew that this would set him up for better things in the world. It's just sad.
It is. I'm really glad, though, that this conversation is so predominant. Like, this discussion of race and racism and how you dress and how you have to look. And especially in these books that are, you know, middle grade books, he could have made Carter a black kid and not included any of that other stuff. I don't think it would have been as good of a book, like as nuanced of a book, but he probably could have done it. And, you know, we have enough to worry about with the Egyptian gods and all this other stuff, but he's really bringing in cultural aspects of being an African American kid. And I think that's, like, so important, especially because a lot of people talk about how that isn't really discussed in the Percy Jackson books. So the fact that Rick wrote these, you know, not long after the Percy Jackson books were finished, that he's already growing and learning and trying to include more into it. And to really see that, like, generational gap, too, because of all of the older black people that I've met in my life, a lot of them have this attitude, whereas the kids, you know, because they haven't faced, I'm not going to say as much racism, maybe not the
direct
same racism.
Openly hostile racism.
Versus somebody who was, like, living in the 60s versus somebody who's living now.
It's a different,
Yeah, it's different. And I think that, you know, even just him talking about that generational gap between the kid and the father was like, okay, like, he's really trying here.
Yeah.
And he's not, like, shoving this under the rug. Like, this is something that he's not letting you look away from.
Yeah. We love an author who learns.
Yeah.
We love it. Okay, so we kind of move on from there. Carter goes downstairs, and he sees Khufu sitting on the couch with his basketball, and he's eating something with pink feathers sticking out of it, and we quickly learn that it's flamingo, because yeah. Khufu only eats foods that end in O's.
Yeah.
Doritos, burritos, flamingos.
Yeah. I love it. I mean, not the flamingo part, but it's really funny that he only eats things ending in O.
It is cute.
Oreos.
Cheerios.
Oh, okay.
He's got all the breakfast. He's got all the food, not food groups, but he's got all the meals covered, I guess.
Mango.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Mm. See? He's got some fruit in there.
We're yeah.
Okay. So then he continues outside. He smells breakfast and takes off for the terrace where he sees Sadie and Amos kind of lounging, eating breakfast. We learn that it's Christmas morning, which is significant for Sadie and Carter because they have not been together on Christmas, especially Christmas morning, since their mom died. So they both kind of take a moment to look at each other like, yeah, it's Christmas. Like, whoa, weird, huh? Yeah, okay. And then they go about their morning. Carter mentions that Amos's clothing includes the blue stone lapis lazuli, which I just thought was very significant and important. So I put it in here so that we would have talked about it in case it comes back to us.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's going to really mean something. Or at least have some sort of property that maybe will be discussed.
I don't really remember. The only thing I know about lapis lazuli from art history is that that is what they used to crush up to make, like, blue pigment. And they would often use that blue pigment for Mary, like, her blue robes and that stuff that she would have, because it was very expensive to make and very, like, vibrant and rich and royal. So lapis lazuli is definitely a rare sort of stone and something that is, you know, usually put on a pedestal, I guess.
Yeah.
But other than that, I don't know if it has a significance.
So I'm just throwing it out there because Carter noticed it, and yes, he's the son of an archaeologist, so I would expect him to understand these things. So he would say, oh, it's blue, whatever. but I wanted to mention it just in case it ended up being significant, because I don't know anything. We are also introduced to Philip of Macedonia, the crocodile.
I just love that that's his name.
I absolutely love this. We learn that crocodiles were kept specifically kind of as protectors, and there used to be large hordes kind of them near the temples and things. And so this is actually, like, traditional, and there's a reason Philip of Macedonia is there, not just to be a croc in the pool, and he really likes bacon.
Yes, he does. And it was, they have a lot of, like, divine power almost and stuff, which I thought was really cool. Amos also mentions, you know, because Carter asks him, like, are there any other pets around here? Any other pets that aren't invisible or something, he says? Like, so there's maybe invisible creatures in the mansion as well, which is a little concerning.
Yeah. Especially because, you know, we've also got Muffin, too, added on to the pet quotient. So, yeah, it's invisible pets. Interesting. We'll see if that comes to fruition later. Okay, so now it's time for some explanation. Amos finally has put it off long enough, and we're finally there. Amos tells us that Julius was summoning Osiris to try and resurrect Sadie and Carter's mom.
Kind of a big deal.
Yes. And it's, you know, he kind of gets across to them that it's not a great idea, but that Julius clearly was not going to be stopped, or, you know, he was not going to give up his thing. So Amos decided to try and help, and so that's why he showed up last night. The gods are real. Duh. LOL. We already knew that because this is a Rick Riordan book, so, like, it's not a surprise to learn that the gods are real. But for Sadie and Carter, it's giant news. Like, this is, you know, world-changing evidence.
And I have to say, I was a little annoyed that Carter's still having trouble coming around to it, because I was like, come on, like, you've seen so much already. Like, I know that it's hard to deal with, but Sadie's just like, yeah, I mean, there's no other explanation, and I really like her attitude about it.
I mean, he just took a morning dream flight.
Yeah.
Come on, dude.
You, like, were a chicken man.
And you saw things happen in that museum. Like, it's time to get on board. So, we learn that Egyptian priests channeling the god's power is the beginning of what magic is in the Kane Chronicles world. So, the ability to manipulate things and to do spells to make things happen and all of that is all based on channeling the gods' power and how the Egyptians, like, learned to harness that. Each temple, and I'm guessing this is each individual temple for all of the different gods, had a branch of magicians called the House of Life. So it's one big House of Life, and each temple had their own branch of it. It's what it sounded like. That's definitely the house that we've been talking about. It's nice to get some answers here. So, yes, Amos is a member of the House of Life, and so was Julius. We will get to that in just a second. The Cains and the Fausts are ancient families of the House of Life, like almost there from the founding, very old established families. And so Julius and their mother coming together as a couple and having children means that they have the possibility to be very powerful magicians, which is worth noting. Amos makes it clear that Egyptian gods are not worshipped as religious icons, because Carter makes a dig at his mom and kind of says, like, oh, my mom's been worshipping Egyptian gods. And he's like, no, we do not worship them. They're beings, but not divine-like deities. They're created entities, kind of like the Greek gods are described. They're not all-powerful. Yes, they have a lot of power, but, like, they're not these religious figures that we all kind of think of when we think of the word God. So
this is so interesting to me, and I'm, like, not prepared to talk about this, so I'm not gonna get into it here. But, like, the Egyptian gods and the Greek gods, like, that is a religion. Like, that mythology is a religion for not only people in ancient Greece, but even still some people today. So this is an interesting explanation, and he specifically says, like, they are no longer worshipped like they used to be, that, like, they've kind of changed, and I wonder if this is simply just an explanation for why maybe they're not at the forefront of culture like they used to be. But I'm like, I don't really know what Rick meant by this exactly, and I want to see if, like, he continues to talk about it.
I do remember in the story here that they said that Thoth taught them that. So I don't know if it's some sort of wisdom that they think they've gained in the time since the gods were revered and worshipped. But yeah, I'm definitely interested to see kind of how this continues to play out.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes on to tell them that the Rosetta Stone that was blasted into a million pieces because of magic and their ability to manipulate things, it's likely repaired and back in its, you know, it's restored, it's safe and sound, it's probably in a storeroom somewhere, and they'll say, oh, that was a fake one, it's fine.
Thank goodness.
Yes, I know. It would be tragedy. It would be absolutely tragic to lose the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
So that's good to know. And he also does a demonstration for them and shows them how he breaks a saucer, like, just tosses it and lets it crash on the pavement and then reassembles it in front of them, which is pretty cool.
And just the visual of, like, even the dust coming back into place to making it perfect was really interesting.
Yeah. As the Egyptian Empire faded and kind of started to come apart, the magic of Egypt itself was collected and concentrated into relics from that time. So many of the things we think of when you think of Egyptian relics and things are now supercharged. And so magicians can use those relics to give them an extra boost if there's a spell they want to do, which is why Julius was looking for the Rosetta Stone in order to bring Osiris back. All of that.
This is so interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Like, the fact that it kind of got concentrated into these relics, and it makes relics very interesting. You know, sort of like, what did they call that in Percy Jackson? The, like, the spoils of war, I think it was. Where, like, the Minotaur's horn was one of them. All of that is just, I really like that.
Yeah. No, I agree. Definitely. So, yes, Julius released the spirit of Osiris, and Amos comments and says, in fact, I think he successfully joined with the god. We do not yet know what that entails or means, but I like to believe that that's why we can continue to think Julius is alive and well and just needs to be saved, even though he's deep in the ground somewhere. At least that's what it looked like. Five gods who were trapped together have been released from the stone, in addition to Osiris, is what it sounds like. So six total, but Osiris is not one of the five troublemakers. Releasing the gods and using their power is now against the law. There was a law that was put into place in Roman times that Julius broke at Cleopatra's Needle when their mom died. So Julius took the blame and was exiled, and the house was monitoring his activity to make sure he wasn't getting himself into trouble, which is why he and Carter had to constantly be on the move, is because the house was watching them. That's a lot.
It is a lot. And for Carter to never know is right. huge.
Like, to know that he's not just an archaeologist who's always, you know, moving from one dig site to another. He, you know, took on that job because, A, it kept him close to Egyptian relics and artifacts. It, you know, allowed him to be on the move constantly without people kind of wondering why, you know, that sort of thing. It all makes a lot of logical sense.
And I like that Carter can think back on all of his memories and go, yeah, that does make sense. Like, now things that, you know, I kind of brushed off before as weird, but, like, didn't think about, now I understand why it was like that.
We also learn that Amos was forbidden to see Julius by the house, which is why he hasn't been around, even though he's their uncle. And Amos tried to stop Julius last night because breaking that law a second time would be a death sentence, but he quickly realized that there was going to be no convincing Julius of that. So instead, he decided to protect the kids and to help the kids, which is why he got them out of London and got them to a place of safety. The house also insisted that Sadie and Carter be separated as children because they would have been too powerful if they were raised together. Amos then mentions, like, you may have noticed that your powers have already been affected and changed, and Carter specifically notes Sadie's being able to read hieroglyphics. He's been feeling some weird, like, surges of power.
Strength.
And, yeah, and strength and things like that. So, yeah, definitely interested to see how more time together, because they've been together, what, like, 10 hours?
Yeah, not very
how
long.
More time together will strengthen both of them. That's definitely at the top of my list of things.
And I like that, you know, it explains why they were separated, too.
Yes. Not just because the court separated them.
Right.
It was the house instrumentally making sure this happened.
And why Julius only visited Sadie once a year with Carter. I mean, that's sad on Sadie's part, though, you know?
And I love that she has a reaction to learning that her dad didn't want to let her go. Like, he wanted her with them. He had every intention of raising them on his own, you know, both of them together, and it was outside of his power to be able to keep her with him. So I liked that for her, that she knows that it, you know, there's other things at work keeping her from her dad, not her dad. At this point, we've basically learned that Amos wants to train them. He wants to teach them how to use their power. And before he can really go further with that, he says, if only I knew what was. And Carter interrupts him and fills him in on his dream with Toad and Rooster and all of that. We learn that Toad and Rooster guys are demons and that sleep is insanely dangerous. It's a doorway to the Duat, which is the world of spirits and magic that is lurking just beneath the waking world, kind of like an ocean. It's kind of described as like an ocean. They actually used it to travel last night. They submerged just below the surface of the Duat, and it allowed them to move at an incredible speed to get to New York in an hour. The headrest that Carter so unwisely put on the floor is enchanted to keep his consciousness anchored to his body. Sadie did not have to be told this. She just assumed it would be significant, so she slept with it, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
So Amos tells him he has to go to Phoenix and see what is happening for himself in order to figure out the whole plan, but he does have a bit of a jump start because Carter told him everything he saw and heard and all of that. He orders Carter and Sadie to stay inside the mansion where they're protected. Muffin is also there to help protect them, which is great. He tells them specifically, do not be tricked into opening the door for anyone, which I just have a feeling that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then he says, do not, absolutely do not under any circumstance go to the library. So as soon as he leaves, Sadie says, so we have to explore the library.
Yeah.
In true demigod fashion.
And one of the things that annoyed me, too, is that Carter keeps asking him who the fiery man is, and he kept not saying who it is.
Yeah, he keeps kind of batting it aside and moving forward and not telling them that one specific fact.
Yeah.
Yes. Hopefully, when Amos makes it back, we will get an answer to that question. But we'll find out. I am really glad that we got some explanation here, though. Mm-hmm. It's time for us to have some details and some information. So I feel a little better knowing at least the basics of what's going on. And that brings us to our favorite quotes and our favorite moments. I will let Karen go first with her favorite quote.
Mine's a little bit long. I'm just going to read the little part in the book. It says, "We were alone in a strange mansion with a baboon, a crocodile, and a weird cat. And apparently the entire world was in danger. I looked at Sadie. What do we do now?" She crossed her arms. "Well, that's obvious, isn't it? We explore the library." I really liked the line, like, "We were alone in a strange mansion with a baboon, a crocodile, and a weird cat." That was almost just my favorite line in and of itself. But then her being like, "We explore the library, duh," was like, I love Sadie.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Mine is also a Sadie quote. Sadie says, "Fight gods?" And Amos says, "Constantly, but we don't worship them. Thoth taught us that." I just loved the whole, like, it's so ingrained in us that demigods fight gods, like, it's a thing.
Yeah.
That it's hilarious to see her kind of learning that, yes, the House of Life is constantly fighting the gods. Like, that cracked me out. And then our favorite moments, for me, it was the explanation, especially the conversation about the Duat. It's different from the Mist. Like, the Mist fixes anything and keeps people from seeing what they, you know, what is actually there. The Duat is this, like, pool of magic and spirits and all
just
of that.
This other realm.
Yeah, just lingering beneath the surface that, it, you know, I find that fascinating, and I'm really interested to see how the Duat plays into the rest of the story and the saga itself.
Yeah.
What was your favorite moment?
I actually really like the flashback to Sadie's 6th birthday party where they exploded the cake, and, like, she had, like, a lump on her face, and there was, like, the cake on the ceiling with the candle still lit hanging from it. Like, I could just envision it so easily. I really hope they put that in the movie.
And Amos was there.
Yeah.
Which Carter remembers now. Like, that was before everything happened with their mom, so that he was there. And, yeah, I did really like that flashback, too. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts as well. Tune in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, and Angel, and more. Not About the Weather is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the new movie, and Jeff Davis's new show Wolfpack is currently getting the same treatment. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can also email us your short-form thoughts, too. Whatever you desire. I just realized I always say long-form, but you can send us anything.
Yeah.
It's fabulous. Find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and that is always a huge help, so we appreciate it. You can leave us questions or comments or ideas for content you want to hear from us in any of these places. We do have one bit of feedback from Twitter, and I'm going to throw it to Karen for that.
Yeah, so after last week's episode, I was still really thinking a lot about Nico and that Bianca D'Angelo article that Reed Riordan put up, so I tweeted, "We were talking about this article last week on the podcast and wondering, can Nico recognize reincarnated and reborn souls since he's the Ghost King? Have we read anything about this before? Does anyone have any fan theories?" And I also talked about Bianca D'Angelo reborn because I can't get that idea out of my head either. And Seaweed Brain Podcast replied and said, "This is an amazing Child of Hades power I fully support. Counter question, does Bianca as a Child of Hades remember her previous life in the next one?" And I was like, oh, I love this. There's so much potential here for a book. She grows up with memories of a past life, drawn to seek out her brother. Maybe there's a prophecy she's unaware of that kicks off a series of events when they finally meet. He has to train her for what's to come. I could write this book, you guys. Let me write this book.
Right. Yeah, I think that's honestly fascinating. And an aspect of demigodhood that we have not been able to dive into because we have not had a child of Hades as a, like, main... I mean, Nico's been a main character, but not a central character. So I feel like Son in the Star is going to give us an opportunity to really find out more about his power and everything that makes him him. And, yeah, I would be fascinated to find out if... what he does, what kind of interactions he does have with the dead, and what power he has over all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention that we are still collecting everybody's unhinged theories about what's going to happen in The Son of the Star, and we really want to read them out in a couple of weeks when we do, like, a little preamble to the book coming out. So send those in if you got them. Bonus points if it includes donuts.
Yes. Agreed. All right. So next week, we're going to be discussing The 39 Clues, The Maze of Bones, written by Rick Riordan,
yes.
The graphic novel. And we will probably be talking with Ethan Young, the... we'll do a little interview. He is the illustrator and the adapter of the novel to graphic novel form. So we're really excited to, A, dive into the graphic novel, but also get a chance to talk to Ethan about that whole process.
Yeah.
And find out how do you do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we're really excited. And we'll also be discussing Red Pyramid Chapter 7, so make sure to read that as well. Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.